Welcome to Building Fortunes Radio. Make sure you check us out at buildingfortunesradio.com. Along with our marketing partners, we're here to help our PM Marketing Network Leads customers build their businesses and make the world a better place. At Building Fortunes, we know how much your business means to you and the people important to you. So spread the word, tell a friend, join our newsletter, and go make a difference in your world. Now on to our show with your host, Peter Mingles.
Hello everyone, Peter Mingles here. You're listening to us on Building Fortunes Radio. It's www.buildingfortunesradio.com. For anybody that might be unfamiliar with my voice, my name is Peter Mingles. We started this whole thing back towards the tail end of 2012, beginning part of 2013. And for some people that don't understand, we have new listeners all the time. So what we like to do is we like to give them a little bit of a backdrop. So we started this as a reference point relative to I wanted a microphone to be able to speak my mind. And what I mean by that is in the MLM world, you get two sides, like the pro-MLM people, all they want to do is talk about how great MLM is. And then the anti-MLM world, all they want to talk about is how MLM is so bad. And being someone that was in MLM and direct sales management and all that sort of stuff, I realized there were many sides and not all good, not all bad. And sometimes, you know, you just got to be able to discuss all these things as if you're going to be able to build any kind of a business. And if you have a mature and or a complex brain, you probably realize that just about everything has some good stuff, some bad stuff, and some stuff you have to kind of work out, walk around, you know, step through, things like that. So we started this radio show because no one else was. And when we started Building Fortunes Radio, I was looking for some guest hosts. We were running for a couple of years. I had read some articles on Seeking Alpha. I guess it was 2015 when Herbalife was being challenged by the FTC, and there was a clash of the hedge fund titans like Bill Ackman and Carl Icahn. They were kind of going back and forth, and then Vima was temporarily shut down by the FTC. I called on a gentleman who was writing. His name is Roger Van Vlissingen, and I asked him to be on our radio show because I like to interview smart people, and he is really very anti-MLM. This is Roger, and he brought a friend of his, E. Robert Smith, who was equally anti-MLM, and all of that sort of stuff. And I did a couple of radio shows with him. Well, Scott Johnson listened to one of those radio shows, called me up shortly after that. It was around this time, 8 years ago, I think Scott has reminded me. And when we did that radio show, Scott said, you know, or when Scott called me back, he said, you know, there's a lot of things that people are not talking about. And I said, what's that, Scott? He said, the tool scam associated with MLM. And I did not know what he meant, because it was the first time I spoke to Scott, what the tool scam was. And I kind of went back into my experiences with Amway and was wondering if he was talking about the same one that I had experienced. See, I had joined Amway once and quit because they saw their focus was not necessarily on selling the products, but, geez, they wanted me to be part of their system. Then I joined again. And I quit again for the same reasons. And the third time, I more or less did it. And just to kind of abbreviate this story, I realized that there was a systems issue. Like more people were making money on the systems than they were on the product sales, or maybe the building of a real genealogy through, you know, building a network marketing company. And I was a little bit frustrated when Scott told me the name of his website, which is stoptheamwaytoolscam.wordpress.com. I realized he was talking about the same thing that I was thinking about as well. And as a result of that, we've been doing these radio shows, and I'm going to say hello to our guest. Hey, Jerome, hang out right there. Jerome, you're coming in. I'm going to finish the introduction with Scott, and whoever you are, we'll be right back with you. So you just kind of hang out. I just wanted to acknowledge that you were here. So sometimes Scott and I do radio shows ourselves. Sometimes we have a guest, and tonight Scott has a guest, and I'm going to let him do the introduction of that. We were just kind of working through some sound check things. That's why his guest just called back in while we were doing the introduction. I'm totally okay with that. But whatever the situation is, I'm going to say if you listen to a half a dozen or so of the radio shows that Scott Johnson and I do, you'll probably be exposed to just about everything you really need to know to hear a lot about the pitfalls associated with MLM. So if you, and if I knew your name, I'd use your name, if you were listening in and you got, you know, scammed or you got hurt or whatever, you lost money, we would probably say, you know, we kind of touched on that, you know, on one of the radio shows that we did recently. So there would be no surprises. So I can't prevent people from getting scammed because that's just kind of like the way it goes sometimes. They do things on their own devices. But what we try to do on our show here is to kind of give you a pretty balanced experience and knowledge of a whole bunch of things that are going on in the home-based business arena. And I'm going to kind of abbreviate my conversation to let Scott do his introduction. And Jerome, I'm going to mute you out, but I'm going to let Scott do his thing, and then I'm going to unmute you as we go. So Scott Johnson, thanks for being here on your own radio show.
Hey, Peter, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. And we do have a great guest tonight, and I'll get into that. But you mentioned the tool scam, and we like to mention what that means in the context of MLM and particularly Amway. And what that is the upper-level distributors sell various things to their downline. It could be tickets to meetings. It could be recordings. It could be phone apps, website access, voicemail, just all kinds of things under the pretense that it's training and motivation, which I don't have a big problem with the content of that information. The big problem I have with it is they don't talk about that's where they make most of their money. And if you want to see some examples of that, you can go to my websites. And the best place to find all the information about what I found about MLMs is on my Facebook page. And it's facebook.com/ScottTexJohnson, ScottTexJohnson. That's all one word. You'll find links to three websites. You'll find link to my YouTube channel, my email, and the link to this radio show. So it's all there. And on my website, you'll find examples of people who got kicked out of Amway, and then they just started talking, and they basically were saying, I made twice as much or more from the tools compared to Amway. I made 10 times as much. My Emeralds and above made four to five times as much. So you'll see just several examples there from all different decades, line of sponsorship, et cetera, showing that there's a lot of money being made on the tools, and it's multiple times more than what they make from Amway. And at the same time, their downline are feeding into that, which makes them lose money. So it's a win-lose proposition big time. And that's something that I've had a lot of difficulty getting traction on that, other than this show, of course, just online. People don't understand the significance of that, especially when you couple it with the fact that many, if not most, of the upline that once achieved a certain pin level, let's say it's diamond or double diamond or emerald, whatever the pin is, they generally don't hold it together, and they go down one or two brackets. And under normal circumstances, if they were making most of their money from Amway, they'd have to go get a job, which would not look good to the downline to have to go get a job again. But because of all the money coming on the tools, it's coming in, and they can lead the same lifestyle as if they still were at that pin. So it's a big deception. It's a big lie all the way around. That's the tool scam. I think it's RICO fraud. I'm not a lawyer, but it's at least business fraud, right? When you leave out the major source of profit in a business because you don't want the people that are paying into it to know about it, then it's definitely business fraud, if not RICO fraud. So that's problem number one. And that problem is not universal. A lot of MLMs don't have tool scams. Some of them do. I know Herbalife does. In fact, back in the early days, it was right before we started this show, there was a fella who was one of the top people in Herbalife as they were being investigated. And Herbalife said, well, within 6 months, you need to phase out your lead generation businesses. And we know that they were charging up to $120 per name, one name, $120. There's actually a video on Bill Ackman's website with a guy saying that. And so at the end of the 6 months, John Peterson was in his driveway in Colorado and put a bullet through his head. That's how much money he was making from the lead generation and Herbalife's version of the tool scam. He just decided, I'm not going to put up with this anymore. Now, I never met John, never knew him. He may have had other demons in his head, but the timing of it was pretty tremendous. So anyway, that's the tool scam. That's not universal. What is, or at least nearly universal, as far as I can tell, is the lack of retail sales. And what we mean by that are sales to people who are not part of the MLM compensation plan. These are real customers, right? Just like you go to a store and you buy something, and that's the end of the deal. You don't go to a store and buy something and they promise to make you wealthy. That's not that's not a customer. That's a distributor. So you don't buy as a customer if you're a distributor. You buy as a distributor, and that's called internal consumption, not sales. So those are two very different, very distinct things. And I have not found solid evidence of any MLM having a lot of retail sales. And we've talked on this show before about some of the insurance MLMs appear to have retail sales. And I think our guest is going to add some information along those lines. But we'll just have to get into the show to determine that, I guess. But we have a great guest here. I've actually been watching reading his website for several years, and very much appreciate his work. And we agree on a whole lot of things. There's very little space between what he has on his website and what we've espoused on this show. And I've been talking about since 2005 when I found out about the tool scam. So welcome, Jerome. Please tell us a little bit about yourself so the audience can understand where you're coming from, you know, your background, your website. You're from down under, and we hope the connection will be maintained. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. My internet service provider did actually warn me that my up speed isn't great, so that might be causing a problem, but hopefully we'll get through it. My background is that, I live in Australia. I did a university degree in commerce, and I did a double major in finance and marketing. So, you know, finance, marketing, it's kind of what MLM is. It's like a sweet spot for them for understanding how they work. I've worked in financial services for almost 20 years. I've done stockbroking, financial advising, mortgage sales. I've pretty much covered the Australian sector. And part of that process was starting my website called The Finance Guy. And the original goal was to teach people to look after their own money. So I wanted to, you know, explain how to read home loans, how to understand interest, you know, why index funds outperform, you know, active funds, little things like that. But that market's very difficult on the internet because, you know, with SEO, paid places, all the banks and investment companies completely dominate it. Then one day I was just kind of thinking back to my past, where, like most people, I've been recruited for MLMs at least 15 times. And I think, Scott, you said you've joined Amway a couple of times. Is that right?
Peter actually joined three times. I joined once.
Okay.
I was in for 12 years or 16 years, depending on how you look at it. But, for several years, for sure.
Okay. Because, I was signed up to Amway without my father met somebody. We're our family's from South Africa, and then we moved to Australia. And somebody that my father knew who moved to Sydney is near the top of Australian Amway. I won't say his name because I don't want to get any feedback from him. But anyway, he's one of the people that has become a multimillionaire, and he's on the motivation tapes, you know, that they send away. The stories, I came here with nothing and I found this opportunity and now I'm rich, and that's supposed to make everybody think they can do it. And I saw MLM from that perspective, that it's all about dangling carrots. So when they say, if you say that it's impossible to make money, it's not. It is possible. It's also possible to win the lottery. It's also possible that I can be cast as the next James Bond because anyone can audition, but it's not going to happen. You know, like it's probability, the probabilities are microscopic, but it is still possible. I got interested in MLM from a young age, and then when people were trying to recruit me, a couple of times I joined because I was interested enough to give it a try and see what would happen. And on two separate occasions, the person trying to recruit me ended up quitting after speaking to me because I talked them out of their MLM. One was OptiMega. Did you remember that one? It shut down in the late 90s, I think.
I don't think I recall that name. Do you, Peter?
It was Omega Trend. Sorry, I think it was called Omega Trend. It might have only been in Australia or something. It was a very strange one, where a bunch of guys from Amway left Amway and started their own MLM, and their compensation plan involved giving you vouchers to spend in their MLM. So you'd get like a percentage as cash and a percentage as vouchers. And I just said to this guy, this is ridiculous. I said, why would you want forced spending? I said, you know, if I'm going to be in a business, I said, if you're telling me this business can grow to large sizes, you're going to end up with an unspendable amount of credits that you're going to have to, what you're going to do, like fill your entire house with groceries and makeup. You'd rather have the cash. And he ended up quitting. And then the next time something like that happened was with Amway. A friend of mine who's a general practitioner, a doctor, was pushing Amway more than he was trying to do medicine. And I went online and found all this research. That's where I started finding like income disclosure statements and finding, you know, their annual reports. And then I started showing it to him. And then he took that on board. And a few months later, he phoned me and he said, yeah, I've dropped out. And he said that I kind of started him on that journey. And I guess that was the motivation for me to write something about MLM on my website. And I thought that, can you make money with multi-level marketing? It's like the first, I put that on the top of my manual, of my alphabetical list, because I thought that would be like a coverall one and people would kind of understand that it applies to all MLMs. But then in the comments section, I kept getting like, oh, can you write one for Sensi? Can you write one for Herbalife? Can you write one for Arbonne? And so I did. I started writing these individual ones. And then the two of the most successful ones happened to be WFG and Primerica. So the two insurance ones, which I got to know quite well, which is what I thought we might look at in more detail if you wanted to, or we can go in whatever direction we end up going.
Yeah, I would like to talk about the insurance MLMs in more detail because I've seen a couple of them do interviews on other YouTube channels, and they claim, the individuals that were on the other channel claimed, that they had hundreds of thousands of dollars per year in retail sales to people who are not distributors, to real customers. And what I don't know are two things. Number one, are they telling the truth? And number two, is that typical? Because, you know, even if they're telling the truth, if it's not typical, then the MLM overall probably does not have what the FTC considers the minimum to be a legitimate MLM, which is a 50-50 split between internal consumption and retail sales to people who are not distributors. And, of course, that's a minimum. You can always exceed 50%, but that's considered the minimum, and I think most MLMs fall short by a large margin. I think very few of them are even close to 50%. Most of them are probably in the single-digit percentages and probably the lower half of the single-digit percentages, you know, like 0 to 5%. So that's, you know, my understanding from just a couple of interviews. It's hard to find a lot of good information, accurate information, other than those anecdotal claims. So whatever you have to add to that discussion would be appreciated.
Yeah. Okay, so just I'll first just go into what you just said there with the requirements for retail sales. And there's a few things in, I call it, I just made up the word legalese. You know, they have small prints in the contracts when distributors sign up. So it's basically to protect the parent company. So the difference between a product-based pyramid scheme and a legitimate business, as you're saying, is a requirement for retail sales. So when they will write something in their contract when you sign saying you must make this much retail sales, you must not order more product until you've used 70% of your previous order or whatever. There's like little requirements like that in there. But then people hyper-consume and hoard products, and then the company's protected because they said, oh, well, this guy wasn't following our instructions. Or if somebody is doing things illegitimately, they'll always say it was that one rogue distributor. You know, you'll always hear these stories like, that person, we've kicked them out now because they were going against policy, but they do nothing to enforce it, and they do nothing to police it. So it's kind of like a gray area, and I think the FTC case with Amway in the late 70s opened the floodgates for them all to just copy and paste that business model.
Yeah, and, you know, my opinion of what the FTC did with the Amway case was they blew it because Amway claimed a certain level of retail sales, and the FTC did not challenge them on that and say, show me your sales receipts. They, to my knowledge, did not object it in any way, and so the understanding in the court was that Amway had a bunch of retail sales, and I don't think they did. I certainly don't think they do today. We wouldn't go back and, you know, re-litigate the 1970s as far as retail sales. It would be much more appropriate to determine what are the retail sales levels today. And we do know from a 2007 lawsuit that disclosed confidential information that the retail sales were on the order of 3.4%. That was done by a third party for Amway. It was released when some distributors got kicked out of Amway and they had access to this confidential information, and they put it in their lawsuit against Amway. So, and that's also consistent with my experience in Amway and talking to many, many other people over the years, that the retail sales is very, very low. In fact, we had a guest on here, Peter, I think it was about a month or so ago, a woman named Megan. 1 month, she did like 80 PV of retail sales, and the minimum is 50. That's what the minimum is supposed to be, is 50. She did 80, and she was celebrated like, you know, she was the greatest saleswoman that ever lived. And she averaged about 20, maybe less than 20 PV per month in retail sales, and that's actually probably pretty high compared to most people. So, you know, it's one of those things that I'm pretty sure, I'm almost certain, Amway does not have anywhere close to 50% retail sales, even though they are trying to put more emphasis on it recently. I say recently, the last 2 or 3 years. I don't think they're making much headway. I mean, my major thesis is if the MLM has overpriced products, then on a large scale,
Scott, let me just interrupt real quick.
Yeah, go ahead.
Jerome, if you have a microphone somewhere near on a wire that's connected to a shirt or something like that, when you move around, yeah, I think it's rubbing against it. So you might have to either just don't move around, or you might have to hold it a little bit, apart or separate from your shirt, because it sounds like when you're just moving back and forth, we hear the rubbing back and forth, which is, you know, just taken away from the quality. So go ahead, Scott, finish up.
Yeah, so, I mean, just to me, the main root cause of the MLM problem, so to speak, is the lack of retail sales. And I actually asked Janet Ammerman, who was the lead FTC attorney against Herbalife. This was back in January of 2017, a few months after the settlement. I had tried contacting her before the settlement. It was sometime in 2015 or early 2016, and I wasn't surprised she didn't call me back because they were in the middle of a investigation and so forth and negotiations. But I asked her, I said, why is it that retail sales are required? In other words, what's so wrong with just the distributors buying the products, and you just find more distributors and they just keep buying the products? And Jerome, I don't know if you have a take on that, but her answer was, you know, very, like you said, legalese. It's precedent. Well, that's true, but it's not really a reason, right? So do you have an opinion on why retail sales are required to have a legitimate MLM?
Yeah, because the legal definition of a product-based pyramid scheme is requires them to have external customers. Otherwise, they are a pyramid, and they by putting, like I said, it's a small print legal protection for themselves, because when somebody comes to try and sue Amway and say I was or any insert name Herbalife whoever it was, I watched betting on Zero, so that on Netflix, so like those people that tried to sue Herbalife, Herbalife's response was, oh, that the people in that area that were promoting to them were going against our policies. So you can't sue us. It's that individual. And what you're going to do? You're going to sue some guy that's you know, maybe worth 100,000 tops. And what's that going to help? It's not going to change anything, because then Herbalife itself is still protected, and they do nothing to stop anyone else from acting that way, because they can't. They can't monitor such a vast sales force with no centralization and no, there's no way to do any compliance checks.
Well, actually, they can monitor them, and in fact, Herbalife agreed in their settlement with the FTC to monitor retail sales, and Herbalife was also required to pay the auditor out of Herbalife's own pocket to conduct the audit and to verify they had retail sales by showing receipts and all these kinds of things. And so it can be done. It was done. I don't know if it was done thoroughly, but it can be done. And there was a really good example somewhat recently. It's been a couple years ago now. The state of Washington in the United States went after a company called LuLaRoe, women's clothing company. Yeah. And one of the things that came out of that was, and this is a settlement, of course, it didn't go to court, but LuLaRoe agreed to supply the Washington State Attorney General with names of their distributors and contact information. And so it doesn't take very long for an average distributor to quit, which means now the Attorney General has the contact information of a lot of former distributors, and certainly if you question a distributor while they're in, they might shade the truth a little bit, but after they quit, you'll probably get a more truthful response. But the FTC could do that across all MLMs, and they could hire all kinds of different firms to do the auditing to see if people really had retail sales, to see if retail sales was being emphasized. But to me, the bottom line is, you either had retail sales or you didn't. It doesn't really matter how much emphasis was put on and how much training, all of those things. It's important to get the retail sales, but the only thing that really matters is that you have them or you don't. And that's, you know, that's kind of my take. And my reasoning for why you have to have retail sales is because, and you've probably heard of the chain letter years ago.
Yeah, the original chain mail.
So there's chain letters. There was the airplane game right in the 1980s. The airplane game. You had one of your reviews on your website, looming something or other.
Blessing loom.
That's one of those gifting schemes. Well, they're all the same, except they don't have products. Now, if you have an MLM with products, typically they're overpriced, and so. To me, the first portion of buying that product, let's say it's twice as much cost as what you can find in a similar product in another outlet, a non-MLM outlet, then the first half of that price is actually legitimate, but the second half of that price is actually the same thing as an airplane game or the looming or the chain mail. And that's what makes it illegal. If you don't have free market demand for those products, then it's an illegal pyramid. Would you agree with that line of thinking?
I think with the pricing, it's one of the many misconceptions of multi-level marketing. I don't know if they still speak like this, but one of the things that used to always irritate me in the day when I'd go like to these Amway presentations, it's cut and paste presentation. They always tell you the same story. The reason why we're doing direct marketing, why would we spend money on advertising and promotions and going into shopping malls when we can sell directly to you? I'm like, yeah, but you're not selling directly to us. You've added like 12 or 15 layers of additional middlemen when you're saying you're selling direct, because you have to fund this exorbitant compensation plan. And I said, then there's also the logistics of with the companies like USADA with little vitamin packets. You know, I said to my friend his wife was interested in joining Rodan and Fields, and he was saying to me all these things like, it's cheaper for them to do it this way. And I said, no, it's not, because if they have to post out little boxes to 100,000 different customers, do you think that will cost them more or less than sending, you know, a whole truck to GNC's Universal Distribution Center, and then GNC from there will sell the vitamins? I said GNC for vitamins because I don't know makeup shops, sorry, but same difference. You get it, like with the pills, why would you, for the company, they would rather sell to the retail outlets, and it just becomes overinflated to fuel it. But the part that makes it the pyramid scheme is not having external customers. I think LuLaRoe that you mentioned is one that's an outlier, because they just had a ridiculously exorbitant entry cost. Like, they made them spend something like $5,000 to buy like literally a rack of clothing. I've seen pictures of these girls with just like vans full of unopened clothes, and the people on Reddit are just, you know, making fun, saying like, you know, they're just like ugly clothes. No wonder nobody wants them. And yeah, LuLaRoe was a strange one, but I think the way they get around the whole retail sales thing in the other ones is companies like USANA, Herbalife, all these ones that have auto ship, where they say, you know, you must spend this much per month to remain active. That to me is an invitation to hyper-consume and to spend on things you don't want and you never wanted in the first place. So if you're going to go to USANA and get 100 PV, because I did that for a couple of months, so I remember that, and you end up taking these little grape seed tablets and this little this and this little that, and you convince yourself that's making you feel better. And then somewhere in the contract it says, I will not order more product until I've consumed or sold 70% of my product, of my inventory. So if they keep sending it to me every month, eventually it's going to start stockpiling. And then if I call them and complain and say, oh, no, you've made me stockpile, they go, no, you were supposed to tell us that you had more than 30% left, so it's your fault. So it's kind of like a backdoor exit. So then when somebody comes to investigate them, they always have these things on their website, on their income disclosure statements, which, as limited as they are, they always have a little story that most people join just to be preferred customers. I'm like, no, they don't. They're in the business opportunity. They're not preferred customers. And that's where I was going to circle back to the insurance ones. Starting with Primerica, they have a special place in my list of 60 companies, because of the 60 MLMs that I've individually reviewed, Primerica is the only one that's made any attempt to take me down. I thought Amway would be first, because I was actually the number one Google result for can you make money with Amway for about 4 years. I'm not anymore. My site's lost some SEO ranking, but I'll try and fix that. And I had copies of their manuals, which can be shared offline, but not to the public. So in their actual new recruits, they called it the new associates manual. Basically, the first, like, they tell you that you have to attend all the training because you have to, you know, be a part of the, you have to become a part of the system. And then it says you have to be a product of the product. You know, you have to protect yourself. And it's basically telling you to buy the insurance and attend all their training and everything. And then you you get to page three, and it's just a blank list to fill in names. So they want you to fill in all everyone you know, and to, you know, they call it macho. So they want people that are married, aged between 25 to 55. The C is for children, H is for homeowners, and the O is for occupation slash employed. So just, but the E wouldn't make a word. So they're telling you to, it's basically a prospecting thing. And then they've even got the booking appointments, the warm market phone script, where they say, tell you to call and say, hi, this is whatever, how are you, wait for a response. I'm calling to ask for your help. And then they want to invite you to what they call a training session. So at this point in the Primerica MLM, they're not a licensed agent yet. They're a recruit. The bottom level of the Primerica MLM is recruit. And they want you to call all of your warm leads whilst you're a recruit. So the person who's training you would get any sales generated. And then once you get your license, your recruits have all been burned. Like when I did my own financial planning license, there's no way I would have done that. Like the way that it works in legitimate financial planning companies is you sit in with an experienced financial planner and you sit there silently in his meetings with his clients and you just take notes and then you keep coming and then eventually he says, okay, now you can do the fact find. You can do like the data collection part of the meeting and I'll sit there because he has to have someone licensed in the room at all times. Because I'll sit there and watch you and give you feedback. And then eventually you get your own license. And then eventually you get the confidence to go on your own. And that's when you start approaching your leads. Because you're not going to, otherwise you can't make money if your leads are already burned. So that was the first thing that really annoyed me about Primerica. Then when I went into, this is an old review. Most of my reviews are old because I haven't been doing it as actively since COVID. So their 2016 annual report is what I looked at, and in the annual reports, they actually said an average of 0.2 life insurance policies per month were sold by each agent, which is 2.6 sales for the year. That's like really nothing. Like if you think about it, even if you round it up to three, it's still only one every 4 months, and that's just not enough to make money. Like if they've obviously overemployed. They've got too many staff. I've worked for big companies as well as small ones. I worked for Citibank for a while, and I liken it to that. Like we had like a team of like five or six people, and we had targets. We had to if we made less than five or six, just like you know, if we made three sales in a week, it would be a bad week. And this is what they're saying is their annual results. So it's very low. On their actual homepage, which I can't access anymore, I don't know if they've blocked it for Australia or if there's something wrong with the Primerica website, but back in 2016, they did actually say that the average earnings per licensed rep was only something very low, like it's in the picture that I made. They earned $6,088, whereas the average income for financial planners in America in that year was $65,832. So they're earning less than 10% of the average of the industry average, whilst telling people that they're like got a made system to turn them into to make them money. And then the next thing, the math. I did a bit of mathematics from their annual report. So in 2016, they had 262,700 new recruits, but only 44,000 became licensed representatives that year. So, you know, reverse. And then in 2015, there were 228,000 new recruits. So even if they were recruits for over a year, only 17% that joined made it to the next level of being licensed. And you look at the total representatives was 116,000. So there was an increase of 44,000, but the total was only 16,000. So then you get that 34,000 or 32% of the entire sales force quit in that 1 year, which is a total revolving door. Like it's obviously not working. And then the next bit of maths that I did from that was In 2015, there were 106,710 licensed representatives in USA and Canada. And so the total number of recruits was 2.6 for each consultant. So the new recruits was 262,000 and the existing reps was 106,000. So 2.6 recruits versus 2.4 sales. So, you know, it's quite an unusual coincidence that the number of so-called retail sales and the number of new recruits was extremely similar. It was almost identical.
Yeah, I agree. That would be very suspect. Now, as far as the amount of money they make, you know, we don't know how hard they applied themselves. You know, like when you were working at Citicorp, that was your job. You were focused on that 100% of your workday. Most people that join MLMs do it part-time. They may or may not apply themselves very hard. I mean, I found that in Amway. When I sponsor somebody, they may put some effort into it. They may not. I would say somewhere between two-thirds and three-quarters either did nothing or they did so little you couldn't even tell. You know, it was just a little bit, and then they quit. And so in my mind, you know, the failure rate, and I know a lot of people like to talk about the failure rate being high, but if you don't really try, did you really fail? You know, or did you just say, hey, I'm going to check this thing out, you join, and then, you know, you get frustrated or you get rejected and you say, I don't like that feeling, and then you fade away. There's a lot of that. I mean, I experienced that personally. So I don't like the comparisons between, you know, failure rate and MLMs and the average income, because you just don't know how much they applied themselves. It's one of those things that it's just hard to use that as a metric. That's why I like the retail sales thing. If you have free market demand, you've got a legitimate MLM. But in your research, if you found that the number of people recruited was very similar to the number of policies being sold, suspicious.
Yeah, it was slightly higher. So some people got recruited and then dropped out without buying a policy. But just to your point of, yeah, it's possible to make money in these companies. But I do write this on most of my reviews. When I say, can you make money with this company? It's normally in my little closing section. I say, yes, you can. But don't kid yourself. It is a self-employed sales job. You're not a business owner. It's not a sure way to make money the way they push it. And if you have the ability and the drive to make money in MLM, the chances are you'll make more money doing it somewhere else. Like if you were going to join WFG or Primerica and you look at their business model where the requirement to actually get up to earning, like you're only earning 25% commission on the lowest level of their ancient Egyptian building structure, then, you know, that's ridiculous. I don't know what it is in America, but in Australia, you can go in from day one and earn 95% of the commission and then just give 5% up to the company who runs the license. So it's purely volume-based, and you're rewarded for your individual performance from day one. Whereas there, in these group companies, there's a requirement to recruit people below you to access higher levels of commission. So you'll have to find retail customers and recruit others and become your own business owner. Like to do all of that effort, you'd, in the normal outside of MLM, you'd make a lot more money and you'd have the freedom of having your own company with no influence of being told you must do this to qualify for that.
Yeah, oh, definitely. And Peter, did you have any comments thus far?
No. Well, I guess yes. So there's a few things. One thing I wanted to point out in what Jerome said about Primerica's approach. Now, it may not be everybody in Primerica's approach, and I'll kind of explain that in a second. But in Primerica's approach, where you gave up your best leads, let's say, or maybe you gave up your personal contacts that would be most likely to buy during the selling or training process, but your upline grabbed them. So your upline grab your best leads. Almost like if, and I'll say this to maybe some guys that might be listening in, it's almost like if you had a friend and he said, give me the list, introduce me to the list of the prettiest girls you know that you'd want to date, and I'll help you talk to them. And when you did that, you said hello, and he took over and wound up dating them all. It's like, what the hell just happened
actually,
here?
It's actually one step worse than that. It's more like, tell me the girls you're interested in, and then watch me date them, so you'll learn how to date. And then they'll... Because that's actually one of the things that says in their book, which, as I said, I'm happy to share privately, but I won't make it publicly accessible because that's what they complained about, is... Like they try, it's like they said, oh, you know, you give us 10 leads, and then by the time you're licensed, those 10 leads, you'll have 100 people to call, because each one of them will give you 10 more leads. I'm like, no, that's not how it works, because if I go to 10 of my friends, and then the first friend is going to give you a list of 10 people, and maybe 3 or 4 of them will be the same 10 that I've got, because we know we're in the same circle. And then by the time you get to like a family member or something, they'll give you the same 6 or 7 family members, and it doesn't actually take that long before you're into like, how do I know you again? You're like, oh, you know someone that I met once at a party 6 years ago. Okay, cool. Do you want to do some business? And then it's like, no, I don't.
Well, here's the insidious nature of that approach, because indirect sales, Primerica isn't the only one. So when I was with the vacuum cleaner business, it was very similar, and even in the books business, it was very similar as far as, I'm going to use the term, preying on someone's warm market list or their hot market list. The philosophy, although many times unspoken, was usually this. You're a new recruit. You're not going to make it. We know you're not going to make it. We're going to use your list, and then we're going to go get another new guy, make all these promises. They're not going to make it, but we're going to use all their list. And basically, recruiting is just another way to be able to capture people's lists of names. And eventually, maybe some of you will stick, but most of you won't. So that churn, and by the way, Jerome, I hear you moving around, so you might want to just watch what you might be, have to watch your microphone. That's okay. So in essence, their business model is built on the inevitable unspoken churn, meaning we're going to churn through all these new people, work through all their warm markets. We'll get to them by telling this fantastical story about how they're going to become rich, and we don't care because it's almost like a never-ending group of new recruits that we could basically bleed. So in the direct sales industry that I was in, I saw some of our managers use that as their business model. Now, I saw other managers use a totally different approach. They were basically going to use people's labor. I'm going to use the vacuum cleaner business. So they would use a shampooing business. Yep, yeah, it does suck. But it's picking up. But anyway, so yeah. The scenario was that what they would do is they would get basically people to shampoo carpets, and by shampooing carpets, which was a separate industry, they would show off their products and be able to make sales, and the income that was generated through the carpet cleaning, which had nothing to do with vacuum cleaner sales, so it was a totally different model, a little bit like the tools analogy that Scott's using, but the business model behind cleaning carpets kept people coming in. Eventually, they'd sell some vacuums. The guy was making money on carpet cleaning and vacuum sales. Somebody could survive on vacuum cleaners and carpet cleaning, and that's how they built their business. And then there were the third business model, which is the one I was involved in, was I don't want to be a carpet cleaner, and I don't want to, you know, churn through people's relationships because I don't want to build a career on pity sales. Can I just learn how to sell legitimately, knock on doors, do trade shows, get real referrals? And that was the method that I chose. But there were three business models spinning around in the same company. The only reason why I mentioned this, three business models spinning around the same company, now think about how the numbers look. You know, my numbers would probably look pretty good and consistent. The guy who was churning through Warren Market would have an income disclosure statement that would look horribly. The guy that was the carpet shampooer would have low income, but consistently low income, and a lot of people would stick around because you didn't see the second income. So in essence, that's why I always have sometimes challenges with companies that provide income disclosures, as, you know, are we trying to base these numbers based on real numbers that really mean something so people can make a decision, or are they just basically a waste of time? And I'll let you address that as well. But since Scott asked the question, you know, did I have any comments, I really did want to emphasize in as many ways as we could the idea that a lot of these companies really do use the warm markets of the new recruits that they know are never going to make it as the way they generate their commissions. And they basically take advantage of that situation, and they build their business model that way. So back to you, Scott.
Yeah, go ahead, Jerome.
Yeah. No, I just it's most businesses have elements that look very similar to MLM, but I always get back to the basic thing, like when they say things like, oh, why it's copying, you know, if you'd got into McDonald's early, you would have made millions of dollars. They're trying to, you know, like imply that they're a franchise model. I said, the problem is when you go into McDonald's and you order a meal, they don't ask you if you want to open your own McDonald's. You know, they don't say, oh, no, you don't want a meal from us. You want to have your own restaurant, don't you? And they'll have another one next door, and actually, why not open another McDonald's inside our dining room because we've got space over there? I mean, that's what it would be like if real business ran like MLM, because everyone would just be opening new branches. There'd be no strategy. There'd be no, looking at the areas. Someone that I know in Sydney worked at one of our fast food chains, one of the more successful ones in the eastern part of Australia. And he was in charge of new franchises. And before he approved a location, he'd go out and he'd study the area and he'd watch, you know, foot flow, look at surrounding shops, what type of competition is there, you know, be very analytical. Well, not just, oh, you want a shop? Sure, have one. We don't care if it's right next door to one of the other ones. Because that's kind of the MLM approach. But just to do a bit of a U-turn, because whilst you were speaking, I was looking at my WFG review. And they didn't ask me to take down their manuals because I found copies of their manuals as well. And if you want an interesting read, I'd say look at their leadership manual, which is inside my World Financial Group review, because they openly push nothing other than recruiting. There's nothing about learn how investment markets work. I always say like in financial planning, I always said like look after your customer and your business will look after itself. So, you know, you treat them right, you put them in the right investment funds. In my early years, I was a bit more, like, zealous. And now at this, you know, at almost 50, I would say just put your money in index funds because it's safe and over the years you'll end up doing all right. But there's nothing like that. There's no financial education. There's no strategy. There's nothing about asset allocation or how to identify customers. It's all about recruiting. And they even have something that they call taprooting, saying like a leg isn't a leg until it's four deep. And you have to, and the whole thing about the fast start bonus, you know, all of them have this whole fast start thing. Like you have to make in the first 30 days, you have to make 30 phone calls, book 10 appointments and get 3 recruits or whatever the numbers are. And if you do that, we'll pay you like $150 from the small ones. And it might be more rewarding from more expensive the goods are. And the reason for that is because it's psychological, is if you've joined an MLM and you've convinced a friend to join, you're now less likely to quit because you feel responsible for your friends. So it's all about, you know, building this, and they talk about it openly in this WFG manual about how the people are less likely to quit once they've recruited someone themselves. And then once it becomes four deep, they think it will become like self-perpetuating. So when they, in their first manual, the introductory one, and in all their presentations, it's very simple. Like you just come and you tell a friend, and then they'll tell a friend, and it'll be self-perpetuating, and it'll look after itself. And then when you get into the leadership levels, it's all of a sudden, no, actually recruiting one or two people won't be enough. You have to find four people who then have to find four, and then one of those four legs might make it four deep. So from, you know, 64 people that have been approached and recruited, you now have a line of four that you consider to be a solid piece of your business. So it goes from tell two or three friends to having to make like 400 or 500 appointments, because you have to make 10 prospecting calls to get one appointment. So then to get 40 prospecting calls, you have to make, you know, like 400, like you end up having to make like thousands of calls, and it's just ridiculous.
And how does that compare with your experience when you were with Citigroup or some other company?
Did you make those calls also, and did you have a certain success
rate?
Yeah, you had a target rate. At Citi, it's the exact opposite. I sat down and was given a portfolio of clients. They were like, here are some clients that, bottom drawer clients. So there's clients that other advisors that were already in the company were no longer servicing because they might have been small balance or they just have fallen off the radar for whatever reason. So they'll put together a portfolio that's got like maybe 100 names in it. And then they'll even send out letters on your behalf. They give you, like, each team has got three assistants. So you've got, I think it was like 8 or 9 financial advisors and then 3 admin assistants. So for the first week, there was an admin assistant just sending out letters on my behalf. So every person on that list got a letter saying, you know, my name is Jerome, I'm your new city advisor. And then from that, you might get like 5 or 6 people calling in saying, oh, hi, how's it going? But then the other thing is you now have a reason to call them. Say, hi, I'm just calling to introduce myself. I can see you've got whatever with us. What are your goals? You chat to them, you chat about what you've got on offer, and you've got a pre-made customer list. So that's how a real business would work. They wouldn't just call you in and say you're on your own. Whereas the smaller companies here do that. If you want to be an independent financial planner, you get a much higher percentage of the commission and you're completely on your own. If you join a large company, it's kind of expected that they'll be doing the marketing and they'll be delivering the clients. So when I was working at a large bank doing home loans, it was literally a physical bank and people would walk in. My personal friends came and did business with me as well, but more than 90% of the money I made was from people walking in off the street, and that was all taken care of for me by the bank. If I was out on my own, and if I'd sold the same number of home loans by myself, I might have earned like 4 or 5 times more money, but I didn't have any marketing, I didn't have a physical office, I didn't have any of these things. So, you know, it's a trade-off.
Right, right, yeah. So it's hard to compare the two because they really are different situations. So I guess my other big thing with Amway, and I wanted you to comment on this, was the tool scam. I see very little discussion about that out there in the, you know, on the internet, and it's been my focus since 2005 when I discovered it myself. And it's amazing how little traction it seems to get. People just don't seem to understand the significance of it, and I just wanted to kind of get your take on that issue.
I'm definitely well aware of it. Have you read Eric Schreiber's book, by any chance, Merchants of Deception?
I have, I think, 2 or 3 times, and I found it to be very accurate as far as, you know, the different interactions and the expectations. You know, one of the things in Amway is you're expected to just listen and shut up, no questions, just believe the quote-unquote gods and accept their wisdom and don't push back at all. Just accept it. Just do what they tell you to do. That's the attitude.
They have good responses ready. I've had a few experiences with Amway, and they get very upset if you show free thought, and if you say things like, if you ask questions like, I want to look at how much people are, like, the last time I was recruited into Amway was when I was already working at the bank, and somebody else from my department had joined Amway, so I went, and this guy met me in a food court after work on a Wednesday, and he's telling me all this, you know, the standard Amway dangling carrots, and the truth is that only donkeys follow dangling carrots, and that's what they're looking for. Because I said to him, like, he says, you're going to have time freedom. I said, well, so your version of time freedom is having a normal job and then spending your hours after work coming out here and speaking to me about Amway when you could be home with your family. And yeah, that didn't go down very well. But just with the tool scam, the time that I did join with my doctor friend, when I just kind of joined for a few weeks with him, I went along to the motivation meeting, to the weekly meeting once, or more than once, like maybe twice. And then the second time, it was the exact same story. I said to him, it's kind of like watching James Bond movies. You know, there's, what, like 24, 25 James Bond movies. Okay, I'll give you the plot. You know, it starts off with some cool music and it gets you all excited. James Bond does something and uses cool equipment and kills a whole bunch of bad guys. Then a really, really bad guy. Then there's music. Then the really, really bad guy surfaces and James Bond spends 90 minutes hunting him down. At the end of the movie, he kills him and he gets the girl. You know, it's 25 movies. I've just described all of them. And it's the same with these Amway meetings. I was poor, then I discovered Amway, now I'm rich, now you should join Amway. Like, why would I pay $10 a week to hear the same story again and again and again? And that's when my friend said, okay, you don't have to come to these meetings anymore. But what really, really triggered them, because this was, it was in the time of iPods, I think it was around about 2006 or thereabouts. It was just before the GFC, because I had just come back from one of my trips to America and I bought the first iPod that came with a video screen on it. And he was loaning me these CDs and his upline was getting angry saying, no, you have to make him buy the CDs. And I said, well, I don't want to hear the same version of the story again and again. What does it matter? And then I said to him, well, I actually put it onto my iPod. And he goes, no, you're not allowed to. That they got very angry with me because like, oh, you've copied it onto an MP3. I'm like, well, my only CD player I have is in my computer. My car didn't have one, and I don't have a portable CD player anymore. The only thing that I listen to is my iPod. So if you want me to actually listen to these things when I'm out on the road, like going to and from work on buses or whatever, it has to be on my iPod. And his upline basically told him not to deal with me because I was asking too many questions. So they get very angry if you question anything, and they say things like, oh, successful people will jump off a cliff and build an airplane on the way down. I'm like, no, they won't. They'll have an airplane and they won't jump at all. They'll have a hang glider. They don't just jump. And like they have all these, they call it like the mindset. Like they always say, oh, you've got the wrong mindset. They have these, it's actually a cult technique for reprogramming your mind to just blindly obey their version of reality. And they, like the whole thing, like they isolate you. They say, you shouldn't have a TV. I can't remember what they call TVs, but something like the TVs, like the dumbification or whatever. It's like your TV is costing you millions of dollars because you're wasting time watching TV. I'm like, well, it's my downtime. If you work 8 hours a day and you want to watch a movie or you want to do something, why not? And that's one of the other things I actually got him to do. We found a TV on the side of the road once someone was throwing out and he picked it up and put it in his house. So I got him to get a TV again. So yeah, the motivation side was very prominent. Like I remember them wanting their $5 to let him come into there and hear that story every week. I'm like, well, don't. I said to him, just don't do it. I said, like, that's going straight into their pocket. And I don't know about the legality of it because as far as, it'd be very hard to monitor, first of all. And the other thing is that a lot of people do things at events. Like they'll say, well, we're going to pay for the event center, but then everyone has to give us $5 just to cover our costs for like the food and the events and whatever. I mean, I've heard that even, you know, things like Alcoholics Anonymous have it. They say, come to the meeting, but give us a gold coin because they're renting out the church hall and putting on coffee and biscuits. So at what point does it become a cash grab? And at what point is it legitimately covering the costs of running these events? But for them, the motivation business is definitely bigger than the actual Amway business. And yeah, Eric went into that quite a lot in his book, where he wasn't really part of the motivation business, and he made it all the way up to the Emerald level and was still losing money. So I think that's a pretty damning example of if Amway works or not, because if you can make it that high up their compensation plan and still be losing money because you're having to go to all these trips and having to maintain the Amway lifestyle, and that's what they expect of you. They almost force it on you.
Yeah, and certainly back in his day, they played favorites, right? If you towed the line, then you got more tool scam money than if you were a troublemaker. They tried to fix that with an accreditation program. I don't know to what level of success, but your story about making an MP3 reminded me one time I mentioned to my upline, well, you know, why can't I just make a copy of, I think it was back in the cassette tape days, why can't I just make a copy of this cassette and give it to somebody? And you'd think I had just kicked their pet dog or something. They were just aghast,
yeah,
you know, that I would even think of something like that, let alone say it out loud. It's the money, right? That's what they're after, is the money. And
yeah,
if you start making copies of stuff,
it,
they're not going to make enough money. It's an amazing thing, no doubt. To me, it's the amount of money they're making. You know, if they were making 5, 10, 15% of what they were making from Amway on the tools, I would say it's no big deal. But when you're making several times that, then it's the big deal. You know, nothing else in my mind can be bigger because it's the vast majority of the profit. And yet they pretend, you know, by all of their talk and actions that their success came from Amway, not the tools. You know, their financial success is what I'm talking about. And that's what I find the worst thing about Amway is how, and Amway Corporate supports that. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at my YouTube channel, but there's a guy on there by the name of Andy Andrews, who was a former Diamond, and he got kicked out in the early 2000s. And he very explicitly said in front of a very large crowd, we make several times more from tools than we do from Amway. And Rich DeVos, I have a recording of him on my YouTube channel. It's only an audio recording. But he talks about, and this is 1983, a long time ago, he said something to the effect of, you know, we know you're making a lot of money. Basically, my attorneys, this is Rich DeVos speaking, my attorneys say if you make more than 10% on tools versus Amway, that we could get in trouble with the government. And I'm such a nice guy. These are my words. I'm such a nice guy, I'll let you go to 20%. Well, these guys are making 500%, 1,000%, and Amway never did anything about it. He threatened them, saying he would hold them accountable, and then nothing. The only place I've seen where there has been action is the UK. Are you familiar with what happened in the UK back around 2007 or so?
No, I missed that, but I know that the UK has taken action against them, and the UK's consumer protection is quite good, and their labor protection, their laws are, they try and look after people a lot more than a lot of other countries, unfortunately. So I didn't share that one in particular.
Yeah, I actually focus on that as one of my three websites. If you go to my Facebook page, there's a website, I think it's amwayukblog.wordpress.com. But the link is on my Facebook page, and you can read all about what happened. They basically, the equivalent of our FTC in the United States, was attempting to kick Amway out of the country. And you can imagine the domino effect that could have had if they were successful. Well, Amway bent over backwards, and they basically said, we'll do anything you want. And the judge, in his final decision, because this went to trial, this was not a settlement, the judge said, you know, you guys were acting really bad, but you've promised to do all these things. And so by a very fine margin, I'm going to allow you to stay in the country. But some of the things that they were required to do is, first of all, you can't recruit anybody until you have a certain amount of retail sales. And I learned recently Amway amended that, saying you can't do that just once. You have to keep doing it. You have to keep retail sales going, or else you're going to fall back in your position.
Yeah.
They also say you can sell tools, but you cannot sell tools for a profit. You have to not make a profit. You can recover your costs, but you can't make a profit from the tools. And I have a whole spreadsheet on that website that shows over the years since that time, because Amway was also required to report annually on certain metrics. And I've got a spreadsheet on that website showing all of the results. And I was talking to Peter just before the show. I just found the 2021 numbers on the UK website, Amway's UK website, and I'll be putting those up on online pretty soon too. But you know, there are countries that have done some things against Amway. The United States is not one of them, so that's why we're here. And to me, you know, one of the most important things I think we can do is not just put information out there, but to work together. To me, that's key, because all the MLMs are together with the DSA, Direct Selling Association. That's their lobbyist in Washington, D.C. They have a headquarters there. They give the politicians lots of money. And the only way, in my mind, that we can overcome that is by working together. You know, our voices together can be so much more powerful than any sort of, you know, political contributions or lobbying, all those things, because when the politicians realize that they may not get reelected, then they're going to start listening to you. But we have to work together to have that kind of influence. And that's my point is, you know, I would really like to work with you and other people that are like-minded together and be more of a presence and more of a force against the MLMs that are telling a very different and very inaccurate story. And so that's, you know, I wanted to kind of get your thoughts on that too, Jerome, because I would love to work with you more, you know, down the road.
Yeah, no, definitely. I definitely would like to do that. And but it's good timing, because you came to me at a time when I was actually just, you know, thinking I need to get back into this website and ramp it up. I'd actually be interested in looking at how the FTC got Advocare down, because, I mean, they did the same math, so I'm not saying they looked at my website, but they had a very similar finding, which was like in 2016, 72.3% of distributors did not earn any compensation. They actually mentioned like the actual figures from Advocare's own compensation plan as part of the reason why they were taken down. And I was like, well, why are other MLMs not being taken down for the same reasons? Because when you look at all of the income disclosures, they're as bad as each other, and they're the legal bare minimum for an income disclosure, and they still try to dress it up. Like they put in these little small print lines, like, you know, they'll have in small print, like there were 200,000 active distributors this year, and they'll say like, you know, 112,000 earned commission. They're like, okay, so 48% earned nothing. Great. And then they'll put a table that only shows you the break the percentages out of those that received an income. So it makes it look bigger than it is. So when I do my breakdowns of their income disclosures, I reverse engineer their own maths. So when their table says, oh, you know, 30% earned between 1,000 and 5,000, I'm like, well, actually, that's only 15%. And then by the time you get to the bottom, you can add up how many distributors earned more than like say 50,000. You call that a full-time income, and it's always like less than 0.5%.
Yeah, and you know, that's where I have a little different opinion, because again, that 30% that didn't make any money, it's probably because they didn't do anything. That's been my personal experience and talking to a lot of other people. There's a very large percentage of people that are assumed to be applying themselves, and they're not. And so I don't personally have a big issue with that breakdown.
No, I mean, I understand that a lot of people will sign up and then do nothing, because it's the same in any job. But the problem is that the way that the business is being promoted, when they're being told, you know, all you have to do is sign up and spend $100 a month on our products, and then you just have to give us two phone numbers, and then the rest will take care of itself. That's the way it's kind of being promoted. Whereas the reality is that it's a job. You're a self-employed salesperson, and if you're not out there grinding and working, you know, working to the bone, you're not going to make it.
Yeah, they do make it sound easier in the beginning, and then reality does set in.
Which is
I don't know if that's an illegal action. You know, to me, the illegal part is, do you have retail sales? If you don't, you're an illegal pyramid. So it's a very cut and dry.
There is bait and switch laws in Australia, so I don't know enough about it to know if that applies or not, but it kind of feels like it's a bait and switch.
Especially with
the WFG one, where there's literally two very different stories in their own manuals, where they've got their introductory manual for new recruits and then their leadership manual, and it's just the tone changes drastically.
We've talked about this before on the show too. You know, Peter's experience with Electrolux. I mean, my experience with, you know, whether it be college or joining the Navy, if people had told me, you know, what amount of work I would have to do to achieve the end goal, I may not have gotten involved. So, you know, I don't see that part of it as totally a negative thing. I don't know if you know, your college came easy to you, or if you had to really apply yourself. If you did have to apply yourself, if they told you in the beginning how hard it would be, do you think maybe you wouldn't have done it?
I kind of wish someone talked me into applying myself more, because I was always lucky in that I kind of cruised through school and managed to get through. I kind of put in minimal effort in high school and got into commerce and, you know, spent a lot of time in the pub with my friends and graduated just shy of a credit average. And, you know, I actually got the first job I ever applied for at a stockbroking company. And I thought life would be that easy. And obviously it wasn't. So reality hit me a bit late in life. But, it does catch up to us. But I think that it's preying on people in financial distress is what bothers me the most, is because like WFG openly goes for what they call first generation Americans. So they're looking for immigrants that might have a lower level of financial literacy, might not even be English, fluent English speakers, and more than likely not English as first language speakers. And then you've got, again, like Primerica saying that they pride themselves on financial education and they think they have like this proven formula for success, and their proven formula pays an average of 90% less than the industry average selling the exact same insurance products. That's where it comes down to. Well, they're selling retail products, and they're earning 90% less than the industry average with their so-called proven formula for success. So, you know, none of these people want to be financial planners. They're joining because they're giving the illusion that it's a way to make money. And it's an easy way to make money.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking, it's been several years ago now, but I was talking with a guy who was a former Amway Platinum, and he was told by his upline, he lives in Minnesota, you know, up in the north central part of the United States, and his upline said, look, and there was a large population of people from Somalia, you know, that had evacuated from Somalia and they moved to Minnesota. And his upline said, you just get one of those people in and the rest of them will come along with them because they trust them. You know, just get one of them and then the rest of them, they'll just flow into your business. So that's definitely a thing. There's no doubt that they know how to work those connections, you know, amongst
people. They get very, very excited about new markets. Because in the mid-90s, when USANA was, I think it was quite new in Australia at that time, one of my friends joined, and the person that directly sponsored him was very successful in USANA. I forgot her name, but she has her own success tapes and whatever in that company. And he put me on a conference call with her, and I was, I think, in first or second year university at that time, and I just kind of mentioned that my college had a very high percentage of international students because our business school had a good reputation, and I was like, it was probably more than 75% you know, international students from Asian countries, like from China and Singapore and the places around Australia, like within a short flight to Perth. And she just got over, you'd think she'd won the lottery. She goes, oh my God, we're not even in Asia yet. I can't believe how much money we can make from those people. Like, I didn't say I was willing to go and randomly start talking to them about if they want to be vitamin salespeople. I just, you know, telling you about the demographics of where I go. You know, it's, they get extremely excited about what they think is untapped markets, because I guess, yeah, I mean, that's when my dad's contact made a lot of money the same way. When Amway finally went to South Africa, apparently his son went and started a business over there and did quite well as well.
Yeah. Peter, did you have any more questions or comments?
We're good. We're good.
All right. So yeah, go ahead.
If he has any websites he wants to give out or any other contact information, we want to make sure we give him the opportunity to do that.
Yep, sure. I mean, my website, it's all in one place. It's financeguy.net. So it's finance-guy.net. That was the best URL I could afford at the time. Let me just do a quick check whilst I'm actually here. It used to be the top result on Google just for finance, for the finance guy. I don't know if it still is. I'm just going to look.
Yeah, we try to ask our guests.
It's the second result. So yeah, it's, if you put the finance guy to Google, yeah, if you put the finance guy to Google, you'll find me, because it's the
So it's finance-guy.net. And yep. Jerome, was there anything that you wanted to cover that you were thinking about before the show or you were thinking of during the show that we didn't get to that you wanted to mention? I always try to give guests, you know, the last word and put out something that's on your mind.
No, I think likewise, I came in expecting that we'd be on the same wavelength, because from what I'd listened to, it was kind of the same way, the way that I present my content is similar to the way that you guys do. And yeah, definitely be open to going further in the future. It's one of those things where, you know, I'm kind of have more information than I have time to share. So, I mean, if you wanted to look at income disclosures or anything in particular in the future, I've got it ready to go. So, yeah, we're definitely keeping an open channel of communication and work towards, I guess, educating the public about MLMs is my strategy, and if I can help you with your goals of political influence to try and shut them down, then I'd definitely be interested in doing that as well.
Yeah, and one of our guests from Australia has said that the Australian schools are now teaching about MLM. Do you know anything about that?
I can tell you that the Australian curriculum, it's quite unusual. You can't say as a blanket statement the schools are teaching about it, because they have a lot of freedom. Like when my kids were young, I looked at the curriculum and each subject, like maths and science and history and whatever, has got some core components each year where you have to teach it. But then inside math, there's the option to teach financial math if you wanted to. And no schools teach it, because it was added recently, and the teachers themselves don't know financial mathematics. So I went around to a few schools and offered to try and run a few classes, and some of them let me. This is going back about 5 or 6 years, or more than that now, probably 8 years now. But the reason why they don't teach it is because they can just recycle last year's lessons and not have to do new work, rather than look through the curriculum and say, oh, now we can teach finance. Let's go and develop new lessons and put in all that time and effort. Whereas they don't have to. And I said, like, I always tell a story. When I went to school, I can take my ruler and I can measure a fish tank and then tell you how many liters are inside it. Or for you guys, it would be gallons, but we're on metric. But by measuring the width, height, and depth, you get the cubic, you know, the cubic size, and then you can convert that to volume. I said, or the same thing with, if you want to know how many square meters my driveway is, give me a measuring tape and I can tell you. I'm like, that's fine, but what's a more useful life skill doing that, or understanding how to balance your checkbook, or understanding when you apply for a loan, understanding how much is going to be interest over the life of that loan and how much is going to be principal. And even the simple things like if you put an extra $100 a month into your home loan, which is, you know, a cup of coffee a day, $3 a day, you could pay your home loan off astronomically faster. You can take 10 years off it easily. So, you know, over the life of the loan, you could save like $250,000 on it and be debt-free 10 years sooner just by doing that simple savings plan, because you're paying every additional payment is premium. You know, there's no interest in that. And the early parts of the loan in particular, 90% of what you're paying is interest and maybe 10% is premium. So you're really accelerating the growth. And if you teach kids things like that at a young age, they'll get an understanding of how money works and become more self-funded. Like the goal, well, not our current, right now Australia's being run by the Labor Party, but our other major party is the Liberal Party, which is our, I guess, closer to our rights, our business people like them. And one of their big platforms is self-funded retirement. So, I mean, obviously a foundation for that would be financial education, which is inside the Australian curriculum but not actually being taught. So I think this probably is definitely the opportunity to teach MLM in some of the subjects, like maybe one of the social studies classes, or in civics and citizenship or whatever. There's definitely the ability for teachers to include it if they choose to, but I think only a very small percentage of teachers would be doing so.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so maybe it's not as universal as this other fellow believes it is. And, of course, it's important what they're teaching, too. I heard just very recently up in Canada that they're starting to teach about MLMs, but it's the perspective is coming from the DSA, which is very concerning, because they're going to be very pro-MLM, obviously, and they're not going to get the whole story, you know.
Well,
you have to get the whole story, not just perspective or the other. It's the whole thing. That's where you can really make an informed decision. So,
that would be my other concern, because I think that unfortunately, teachers is a subset that are actually kind of vulnerable to joining MLMs because they have discretionary time and they want more income, and then they might target their children's parents as downlines. And when there is subjects, you know, some of the stuff they do in the schools is like showing kids how to do, you know, make their own little businesses and things. So I can see them coming in a predatory sense and trying to present MLM in a positive light, it could be pretty dangerous, because you could get these kids going home and trying to recruit their parents into an MLM, you know, because they learned it in school.
Right. No, absolutely. Yeah. If it's not balanced, then, you know, you're going to get one extreme or the other. And in my mind, both extremes are not the whole picture. The whole picture has to be viewed, and then someone can make an informed decision. So anyway, Jerome, it's been a pleasure. This has been just a great show, I think. Peter, I'll let you make any last comments and wrap it up.
Excellent. Okay, good. Oops. So for those people listening in, you just heard from Jerome. I believe Jerome, your last name is Rosenberg. So we're going to make sure that we have a guest page. So if you go back to buildingforgeradio.com, look for guests, we're going to have Jerome Rosenberg up there, the finance guy. He's got a lot of really great information on his website. His website is finance-guy.net, and he's got income disclosures, he's got little reviews, a whole bunch of other things as well. We'll have him come back. I'm interested in kind of just having an open conversation with a financial planner and somebody who's done discussions on income disclosure plans. So we can kind of talk back and forth about that and have an open discussion about either the value or the purpose or the intent of those things as well. And you can always hear this radio show again if you go back to buildingfortuneradio.com and look for Scott Johnson. And Scott, just give your website one last time for those people that want to have access to your website too.
Okay, yes, facebook.com/ScottTexJohnson, ScottTexJohnson. I've got three website links on there. The link to this radio show, my YouTube, my email. And Peter, I think that's a great topic. If we can have Drew back again sometime to talk about those income disclosures, because I know both of us have some very strong opinions on the value of those documents, and that would be a really good discussion, I think, particularly with a finance guy, you know, I should say the finance guy. That would be a very good discussion for us to have in a future show. But anyway, thanks again, Jerome, and Peter, we'll see you next week.
Thank you, Jerome. Thanks for spending your time with us, and we'll catch everybody next time. Thanks, everyone.
You've been listening to Building Fortunes Radio on buildingfortunesradio.com. Thanks for listening. Be sure to check us out every Friday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time for the designated Building Fortunes Radio segment with Peter Mingle. Be sure to check out the buildingfortunesradio.com website for our featured segments. It's been our privilege to have you listen in. At Building Fortunes Radio, we wish you the success you deserve and are willing to work for. So spread the word, tell a friend, join our newsletter, and go make a difference in your world.